Welcome to The Artistic Foodies, the show that explores life through the lens of art and food. I'm Abbas Muhammad.
And I'm Irfan Raidan.
And today we're continuing our conversation about third spaces, specifically in the Muslim community. What does it actually mean to be a third space? What role do they play in the direction of the Muslim community in America is heading? And how can we be a part of that? We are taking a deep dive today in this episode, so make sure you listen all the way through.
Abbas Raidani is a process artist, filmmaker, producer, human enthusiast, and founding director of the award-winning Muslim arts and culture collective, Mipsters. He brings over 20 years of experience in prototyping creative ideas, building community, and enabling flourishing artists. At Minara, Abbas works to take your ideas of what a catalytic space should be and turns them into something you can feel.
Abbas Raidani, thank you for joining us on the Artistic Foodies. Can you give us a little bit of introduction about yourself, where you're from, what type of work you do, and how you are involved in the Mipsters?
Man, that's a lot of sub-questions in one larger question. Mipsters was started in 2012 by me and a few other artistic, creative Muslims in New York City. Ramadan 2012, magical year for a lot of us millennials at that time. Growing up, I think, in the post 9/11 world, there was this, I think, you know, forced otherization on a lot of Muslims. And we were all very young and we grew up in this context thinking about how we had nothing to do with this thing, but this thing very much in real time and for decades afterwards shaped our reality. The other thing was that there wasn't much infrastructure or mentorship available in the arts and artistic spaces for Muslim folks. I remember as a undergraduate student who really wanted to pursue stand-up comedy, I think the only Muslim stand-up comedian that I can think of was Asif Manvi on The Daily Show. That was very prominent.
Oh, yeah, I remember Asif. That was like, you're talking old days.
Yeah, and I remember auditioning for things, and at that time, Aziz Ansari was very big, and everyone was like, yeah, we already have a brown guy with a beard. We don't need any additional Muslim folks. And, you know, I was doing comedy right around the same time that Rami Yusuf was, Hasan Minhaj was. And it became very clear that, you know, there wasn't much in the way of resources and infrastructure for us to succeed. They are the ones we know their names because they succeeded, but they'll tell you that they had a lot of peers that they collaborated with and they worked with that try to make it, you know, in the art space or the creative space, that had to pivot in many directions. And so, you know, growing up in that kind of environment, moving to New York City, deciding to pursue that as my full-time career, looking around and seeing, you know, who else is here, who else is doing this awesome stuff. I ran into Layla Shakely, Zainab Shakely, who, you know, are brought up on the, in LA. Such amazing folks. I think they kind of just changed my entire perspective because they grew up in a LA community that was very supportive. Omar Effendim, you know, comes out of that community. Samira Drews comes out of that community. Rami El Tribi. And so, you know, the LA Muslim community was very different from the New York community. And just being inspired by these new Muslims that I was interacting with and interfacing with, I think Mipsters just kind of organically grew as a listserv. We just kept throwing people on this email listserv who expressed some interest in arts, creativity, that's intellectual creativity, thought, poetics, etc. And, you know, one project led to another project. One project goes viral, draws in more folks, and it grows and grows. And so that's, I'd say the story writes itself from there.
And that was the, you're talking about the Mipsters movie. Before Mipsters was an organization, it was a movie or a film, I should say.
Actually, no. I mean, it was actually just a collective of Muslim and Muslim adjacent people. And by Muslim adjacent, I mean, there were a lot of folks who we met that either had one parent that was Muslim, that either grew up in a community around Muslims, like Armenians and Druze and, you know, they or Coptics, et cetera. They grew up in like primarily Muslim environments. And so they resonated with the Islamic tradition on a larger scale. And we all kind of got together on a regular basis, oftentimes in New York City or, you know, Boston, Philly, you know, I-95, you know, as well as in LA. And we decided to do a project, and our first project was this short montage, experimental montage film, depicting the very reality that we were all living in. It was very much inspired by, you know, Layla Shakely, the executive producer of that short film. Mm-hmm. Who was this, you know, Muslim hijabi skateboarder, and she roped in all of her friends. I went to college across the street from Ibtihaj Muhammad. We had gone to a Lupe Fiasco concert in college, and, you know, I just hit her up years later when she was training for the Olympics and said, hey, I'm putting this film together. Do you want to be in it? And just organically, all of these folks kind of came together, and that short film just went viral, and more people learned about us. And, you know, it just became an environment where we could just collectively share our thoughts and work on projects collaboratively. And that's what we kept doing.
Yeah, there was almost like this moment where it seemed like the collective needed it. Because I remember when that film came out, and it's like, whoa, I've had, you know, what, one foot in the hipster world, one foot, you know, in the mosque. And I'm like, wait, I'm not the only one. I'm not the only strange person. I'm not the only weirdo. In fact, here's a video full of people, you know, hijabis on skateboarders. You know what I'm saying? We got the fashion thing going. And that was very validating. And I want to say it was around that time that Nadir Nadia of London, he had published a video that also went viral. And now he's named one of the most influential Londoners. But I remember that took off with a specific video as well. So it seemed like it was a collective need at the time. And it kind of reminds me of, we had Shah Jahan on a previous episode, but it kind of reminds me of the Kaminas and the Taqwa Core movement, and how the Kaminas were actually kind of a little bit ahead of their time, and really opened the door for a lot of these things to exist. You know, I can't imagine what the Muslim art world would be like without them cracking the door open and leading the way in the way that they did. I also love what you said about Muslim adjacent, because when we talk about the Islam as a spectrum or the Islamicate, it's like, where do you draw the line? Because you have to draw a line somewhere. And for me personally, that line has moved, has shifted. One very memorable moment was when I went to go visit Chicago. Shout out to my boy Adonis. He showed me around the city. I hung out with a lot of Muslims on that trip, but only one person took me to the mosque to pray, took me to Qalbu Maryam Mosque, the Nation of Islam headquarters mosque. And this was someone who had not taken the Shahada. So that completely, you know, opened my eyes to like what it means to be Muslim in your heart, what it means to be Muslim on the outside. And so I really love that idea of like, well, what is the Islamicate? What is the Muslim spectrum? So I bring this up because, you know, hopefully we can get into this when we talk about third spaces. When we talk about third spaces in the Muslim community, it's a lot deeper than, you know, what it seems like at that surface. So before we get into that, like, what's your journey been like? I'm seeing you in a completely different light right now. If anyone Googles you, it's always like the cool hat and the very vibrant colors. And right now I'm looking at you, you have a dress shirt on, you got a filing cabinet behind you. It's kind of shocking, you know? So what's your journey? And like, how did you get into this? Would you call it a pivot? What would you call it?
Get into what specifically? Being in front of a filing cabinet?
Which one came first, right? So like, how'd you get into the art world with Mipsters and all the stuff that you're doing right now?
I mean, I don't particularly think I have any talent, you know. I think I just have a lot of enthusiasm, and I think I light up when I'm around talented people and they are experiencing their passions or playing out their passions in real time. I'm drawn to live music. I'm drawn to performers, artists, illustrators, thinkers, etc. Anybody who is essentially, you know, I'm just gravitate towards passion. And I would say, you know, effectively, I don't actually have any talent that I can think of. And so I kind of label myself as a process artist, which has been defined as somebody who's interested in the means by which art is made more so than the end product. And so I very much really relish when you bring talented folks together and there's this pre-moment, this pre-creation moment that happens where they're feeling out the other collaborators, they're putting stuff out there. It's basically how if you listen to the beginnings of jazz music, somebody plays a note and another one picks up on that note and it kind of builds from there. So my journey is similar to that. I think I gravitated towards performance. I gravitated towards satire and comedy. I started there. I majored in religious studies with a focus on Islamic studies. I had Carl Ernst and Omid Safi as my teachers, and they really instilled this interest and love for intellectual.
Shout out to Omid Safi, our homie, our Jedi Sufi homie. Yes,
definitely. You would take that as a big compliment, calling him a Jedi Sufi. And I think what I realized was, could I use other means and mechanics for translating what I'm learning in the classroom and make it more accessible to the wider public? And so comedy very easily became that for me. And I started there. I, in the meantime, on the side, continued my interests in philosophy and thought and thinking, and how do we take these larger, broader concepts that shape identity, that shape our communities, and make it a little bit more accessible. I brought up the whole 9/11 piece, and I think, you know, and you brought up the Kaminas. In many ways, I think we were all getting at the same thing, which is we have nothing to do with any of this geopolitical garbage that's being forced upon us. We're just all a bunch of kids who grew up, you know, in our respective environments. Like in high school, I grew up listening to the Dead Kennedys and NoFX and other punk rock, you know, very much like the Kaminas did. They actually had talent and could play music. I just listened to that, to the music. But punk rock is such an American phenomenon, right? Like that's a very American thing. So then to be told like, hey, you're not from here, you know, go back. It seems funny to me, right? And I think it's humorous to me. And I think Jordan Peele kind of highlighted why he leaned into horror, because sometimes comedy is a form of processing the horrors in which you are living in, you know, and he started off in the comedic world. And so I think that's where I started. Ultimately, you know, I thought about through comedy, through art, I think I started contemplating more deeply about what it is I wanted to achieve. And for me, I kept going back to this concept of well-being and belonging, I would say. I think I grew up thinking, you know, as somebody who was on the periphery when I was in college, you know, my MSA was very unkind. This was 2005 to 2009. It was an MSA that was very exclusive instead of inclusive, and it really boxed out Muslims. They had a banner of who counted as Muslim and who didn't count as Muslim. And so now imagine on both ends, you have the 9/11 backdrop of who is or isn't, you know, a citizen of this country. And then on the other side, you have this highly exclusive environment where it says who is and isn't Muslim. And then I think I found myself in this middle ground, and I thought overwhelming.
So you're both too Muslim and not Muslim enough at the same time.
Exactly, exactly. And I think I found myself thinking, you know, what am I doing all of this or any of this for? What is my natural like soul gravitating towards? And I think it's, you know, having felt not belonging, I think I thought to myself, I never want anybody to feel this way. So a lot of my work ended up just focusing on marginalized communities, marginalized creatives, marginalized artists, people who are like, well, I don't want to be, you know, I don't think of myself as Muslim because others don't think of me as Muslim, but I gravitate towards the deen. And I'm like, well, then you're Muslim, you know, like you, no one should make you feel like you aren't something. And I think overwhelmingly, you know, well-being, belonging, it has impacts on your health. I mean, it leads to anxiety, it leads to depression, it leads to loneliness, et cetera. And I think naturally that bleeds into the field of health. And then ultimately I decided to, you know, pivot, study medicine. While studying medicine, I still pursued things around Islamic ethics, art, creativity through Mipsters. The team kept growing. I had like, you know, one tentacle still within that realm. And then now...
And then you just casually pick up a master's in bioethics and a doctorate along the way, casually.
Yeah. Very casually along the way. I think, you know, I was really propelled, you know, it was very casual in that because I think ultimately I was just propelled by this thirst to learn and create something so that the next generation never had to feel that way. And I think one of the big... you know, one of the big joys is seeing, you know, Gen Z and Gen Alpha think Mipsters is lame as hell because there's so many alternatives. And I'm like, that is such a subhanAllah moment because now things have become so ubiquitous, right? There's so many channels, there's so many opportunities for marginalized Muslims to feel like they have a home. And there's so many micro niches that are being created where people feel belonging. Mipsters was never created so that all Muslims can feel belonging. It was created so that a few of us could collaborate with each other to find a sense of meaning and to be seen, see and be seen by our peers.
Yeah. So you're essentially, it's like we do this work so we can create a world in which we don't need to exist.
100%, right? We're on this planet. There's this hadith by the Prophet Muhammad Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam that's like, you know, you enter this world as a stranger and you should leave this world as a stranger, right? You shouldn't have attachments to this world. So I'm not like, you know, if Mipsters is done, you know, and it's gone because something else has come and gone and this perpetual cycle of coming and going, I think our time on this planet is very temporary, right? So, that was a great moment to be like, oh, the youth have, you know, created their own infrastructure. And partially because of technology, you know, social media technology has allowed more accessibility for us to create things with such ease. I think with, you know, vibe coding and all this other stuff, that's making things a little bit easier to create now.
It's a vibe coding.
Vibe coding, yes.
So vibe, vibe.
So I think you know, that's kind of where things are, and a lot of my focus professionally has been on social determinants of health, on well-being, on, you know, stresses as it relates to impacts on health, and then that largely turns into my interests around process art and how communities can explore their own identities and who they are and, you know, self-actualize by being, you know, with like-minded folks.
I think that's a very interesting what you're just talking about. It reminded me about a friend of mine who is a Muslim convert. He is someone who was a professional skateboarder before he became Muslim. And he was like one of the top 25 in the U.S. when he was like a teenager. So he went through all that process of, as you mentioned, about process. So I think being Muslim is also a process because basically he went through this stage where after he became Muslim in his 20s, he went really, really hardcore into the Salafi kind of realm. And he cut off his doing skateboarding, and he's, you know, because people were telling him, hey, that's haram or whatever to do that kind of stuff. And then later on,
I love that a mode of transportation is haram.
Yeah, I think they probably meant like the environment that he was, that
is bidah.
Yeah, but
watch out for the bidah, bros.
Yeah, exactly. And then he came back into skateboarding and by like teaching kids to do it, and he set up a school, and now he's like an entrepreneur, but his kind of Islam, learning about Islam, and it's a process, you know, for everybody, I think. And that's something that I think a lot of young people need to realize as well, is that we're always kind of, you know, we have young kids, so we're teaching our kids about Islam, and then sometimes they get pushed away because they think that being Muslim is one specific way to practice. And if you don't do that, like you mentioned earlier about the MSA, it's a very sad situation, because in college, that's a very important time where young kids are learning about themselves, right? How are they gonna develop into what type of people they want to be. But anyways, getting back into the subject of third spaces, can you tell us a little bit about, first of all, tell us what's your definition of a third space, and tell us about Minara and how did you start that organization?
Yeah, I mean, Minara is technically a sub-project of Mipsters, and you know, with what essentially happened was, we had, through this online listserv, we had also been doing a lot of in-person meetups and gatherings. You know, there's so much value in meeting people face to face than just living in the digital world. And so even though we had this like email listserv, people behaved differently on the email list than they did in person. And people are more likely to be, I don't know, for better or for worse, maybe they're their true self on an email.
The keyboard warriors.
Yeah, exactly. Maybe they can hide behind, you know, the safety and comfort of a screen and spew all kinds of stuff. And you know, adab and decorum kind of falls by the wayside. But then when you see people in in person, you know, they're more prone to act with manners and with respect. And so... Also, it diffuses, right? Like, I think the TV screen or the monitor allows you to otherize, I think, people a little bit more quickly than when you just sit down with them and break bread. So we used to have a lot of in-person gatherings and hangouts and jam sessions and collaborative creation sessions. And the one thing that kept coming up after all of them was, all right, when's the next one? And we would be like, you know, I don't know, you know, when we can get a venue again, when the weather is okay, when we can, you know, have it, when we have enough money to like rent out a space. And it just became so sporadic and spread out that it really hurts one's ability to build community. You know, I think you need reliability, you need consistency in order to build and even foster sustainability, right? Like if you can't continuously meet in a location on a regular basis, and there's an, you know, like then how do you expect to create? I think that's why Ramadan is so magical, is because every Muslim knows that at an exact time, no matter where you are in the city, somebody is looking to break bread and pray and be together in community, right? So it's so easy. You just pop in, you know, if you're in New York City, you pop into the basement of an Albanian bodega or, you know, a Bosnian grocery store or whatever. And there's, you know, you're welcomed there. And I think where the way Minara came about was, you know, one of the big hubs for where a lot of us creatives were based out of was actually Boston, Cambridge, Harvard and MIT. You know, for all of their faults, is a hub for just very fascinating and interesting people on a rotating basis. Every year they welcome new students in. There's fascinating and interesting faculty that are working on different things around the clock. So Cambridge very quickly became a hub for a lot of what we were doing in addition to New York. And New York and Cambridge are very close. And as you can imagine, Harvard and MIT also attracts a talent from all over the world. But that same talent are also looking for fellow Muslims. And so we used to meet in spaces, you know, that were community-driven, arts-driven, that maybe you could call them proto, early, quasi, third space. And they were really open to everyone and anyone, but mainly the artistic community were the ones that populated these spaces. They ran out of funding, they shut down, et cetera, et cetera. And then most recently, we ended up receiving a pretty sizable grant from a Massachusetts-based philanthropist called the Barr Foundation. And we really thought long and hard of as to like what would be a meaningful project. And we just came off of our larger, this like traveling project called Alhamdu Muslim Futurism, where we basically went to parts of the United States that had Muslim minorities, if not almost no Muslim population, pretty homogenous, territorially Christian. And we set up shop and created a thing with the name Muslim in the title and kind of studied how people interfaced with it. And what we found was that when people suspended their judgment and entered the space, they were very much motivated by it. They were inspired by it. And this is not just anecdotal. We actually formally studied it. And this is like where my medical background kind of crept in. And we kind of actually studied that non-Muslims witnessing Muslim art actually increased their love of Muslims, you know? And we measured that. Yeah. And so
send me that publication. I'm sure that's a scientific paper right there.
Yeah. Yeah. It's actually about to be submitted. So, you know, stay tuned. The findings
Mashallah, brother.
And so when we had this, and when we witnessed that, I think, that also planted the seed for thinking about our next project. And then finally, when I visited Paris for the first time, I hung out with a bunch of Muslims, Parisian Muslims. And I remember this one moment, we were standing in line. This line was wrapping around the block. And while standing in line, these Parisian Muslims were kind of telling me about how awful it is being Muslim in France, and how you can't be hijabi, and how people look at you weird. And they were physicians themselves. They're like, in medical school, we learned about the Arab syndrome, how like Arabs hyperbolize their symptoms and, you know, blah, 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 blah.
That's a thing, the Arab syndrome?
Yeah, it's kind of like how overwhelmingly Hispanic folks and Black folks are treated in the emergency rooms, right? They have high pain tolerance. That's just like, you know, that's just genetic. And, you know, it's just like a neo form of eugenics, you know, or these like thoughts of like, you know, scientific racism. And so while they were telling me this, I mean, like, I'm heartbroken, you know, in America, Black Lives Matter movement was happening, this racial reckoning was happening in the United States at the same time. And I was just really reflecting, and the line just like kept progressing. And I was like, wait a minute, this like cafe that we're going to is owned by Muslims though, right? Like, you just told me that this cafe that we're going to is run by Muslims. Why is this line wrapping around the block? I thought you said people hate Muslims. They're like, yeah, but the French really love food and they will suspend their prejudice. They'll suspend their prejudice for really good food. And so me thinking. I was like, oh my gosh.
They have the shawarma.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, this was not even like shawarma. This was just like tagine and other Moroccan dishes or whatever, you know? And it made me think like, okay, what if we created a place that was four walls, it was reliable, it was kind of a blank slate anybody could come to, and the food there was just so good, it suspended people's judgment as to what the place was, kind of like our exhibit did. And so we, with this grant, we just created a pilot project. It was 4 months long, Minara, and within, you know, 3-4 months time, we had 3,000 people pop in, did 90 programs. A lot of those programs were community driven. The menu rotated frequently. It featured stuff from all over the world. You know, obviously, you know, my fatherland of Tanzania, you know, there's West African, Indian, Yemeni, et cetera, et cetera, with bean pies were imported from New York, et cetera. And people were just exposed to so much diversity that it like created a future world, you know, and coming off of Muslim Futurism as our project, I think this was, we're creating the future that we wanted to live in for that short period of time. And then alhamdulillah, you know, when we reached back out to the community and said, hey, did you guys think this had any impact or any meaning? People donated pretty generously to have Minara 2.0 come about. And so that's what I've been working on, trying to create that third space, you know, example out here.
And now, a word from our sponsors. This episode of the Artistic Foodies podcast is brought to you by Deccan Morsels, your destination for authentic Hyderabadi street food and unforgettable flavors. Craving a perfectly brewed Irani chai, buttery bun muska, crispy onion samosas, or maybe their famous and my favorite Rumali chicken 65 roll? Deccan Morsels brings the rich culinary heritage of the Deccan to every bite. Whether you're stopping in for a late night snack, dining with friends, or grabbing takeout, visit one of their convenient locations in Fremont, Pleasanton, Sunnyvale, Tracy, or Irving, Texas. Deccan Morsels, bringing the authentic taste of South India to the USA. And inshallah, our du'as go out to all the success, continued success. In fact, I hope that it continues long enough that I can come and pay a visit as well.
You should. We got to host an episode of this live.
Yeah, we'll do it. Hey, you know, I think the world's just been waiting for at least a decade for a Gamma Mipsters collab. So
100%.
Let's get in the kitchen and cook something up. I want to ask like one final question. Just get, you know, you talk about philosophy, get deep into this with us.
Yeah.
What role do third spaces like yours play in the direction the Muslim community is heading in America specifically, but even just overall? Where are we going and what role do these spaces play?
Look, I think, you know, we know this from a lot of psychological studies that part of human development is that you reach an existential moment in your life. It's usually at the latter half of your teens and early 20s. Everybody goes through it. You know, some people call it an existential crisis or an existential reckoning. But you essentially sit with yourself and you think, who am I? What is my role in the world? You know, where do I belong? What is meaningful to me? Where do I derive meaning? What are my values? And you either reflect upon where you've come from, you know, like your parents' upbringing or the community that you grew up in or other friends that you have. And then you also reflect on your current state, you know, and this is the time that people are in college. It's pretty transformative. They're being exposed to new ideas, new communities, etc. And then you pick a path, right? You start charting your own path. And in my experience in college, I, you know, started reflecting on the fact that I grew up in a community that was very encouraging of thought, of intellectual diversity within Islam. Islam was very fun. Because we were exposed to the diversity of the deen at a very young age. The mosque was the hangout spot. You know, we had like a, you know, soccer field attached to it and people hung out. And we went to the mosque like 3-4 times a week, you know, and we wanted
to be. What mosque was this? Where was it?
This was in Queens. And so we loved just like hanging out there. They had food there for us. The young folks, you know, they had a lot of opportunities to just hang out among the young folks. And then when I go to college and I'm learning, you know, Islam formally from an academic perspective, and I'm just, you know, very excited and being told by fellow Muslims, oh, don't learn Islam in the academic settings. You'll become an atheist. Or, you know, and this happened to some Christian.
Crazy.
No, but this, to be honest, it happens, right? This is part of the existential development, right? I think a lot of Christian classmates of mine studied Christianity from the academic lens. Like, there's this famous book called Misquoting Jesus by Bart Ehrman. Bart Ehrman was the former chair of the religious studies department at my university. And so a lot of these students, after learning about Christianity, who were very gung-ho Christian, used to attend Christian services in high school and middle school, were like, yeah, this isn't for me anymore. And so I think Muslims reflected on that and was like, oh, they're teaching a version of Islam that will cause you to separate from the deen. If anything, and you know Omid Safi, right? Like, if anything, it made me more attached and it caused me to gravitate towards the deen even more. But then on the other side, to be told, oh, you aren't Muslim. Like, flat out, you aren't Muslim by the MSA leadership. This is not like people who go to MSA. This is the, you know, very self-righteous, we are the shura. They're using terms like that to self-impose authority. It was very odd. And I think, you know, where do third spaces play? I think it's supposed to be just a space where you show up. There's other folks there. They're all going through this existential moment. And you're going through it together. You're putting out ideas. There is no embarrassment of sharing of ideas. There's a lot of dialogue. There's conversation. People put out their ideas into the world and they're received. And, you know, feedback is generated, et cetera. I think for me, a third space is that. It's where creativity in terms of thought, in terms of just expression, can flourish. It's where people can feel safe. You know, psychological safety is key, where people can just kind of be themselves and share what it is that's on their mind. You know, I think about the number of like queer Muslims who are now in this, you know, in this interesting situation where they're like, oh, we're Muslim, we are queer, we love the deen, we want to grow in the deen. And then when other like cis hetero folks hear the word queer, they're immediately, oh, no, you're not invited here, you're not welcome here. And you're like, what? You like, this is not even your business, right? Like, that's like, the poor person is just trying to be and understand who they are in the world. And then who the hell are you to like just jump in and just like box somebody out like that? I think that really hurts me, right? Like, I think that really bothers me. And I think there are spaces like that for those people, right? Like, when people say, people ask me this question all the time. They're like, hey man, how come we didn't see you at this mosque event? How come we didn't see you at this mosque gathering? And I say, my work is not for those who are so in tune with who they are that they show up to the mosque regularly. My work is not with the people who show up to Jummah prayer. My work is with the people who are like, I don't think I qualify to show up to Jummah prayer. I don't think I'm Muslim enough, because that's not what I've been told, to show up to this mosque event, right? Like, my work is, you know, out here on the streets, you know, essentially to say that there's a whole population of folks that are questioning whether they belong or not, right? And I think, you know, I can't remember who said this, but he was giving a sermon in the masjid and said, you know, we are here in the mosque debating the attributes of God while there are Muslims out there, you know, debating whether or not God exists, right? And I think what's painful to me is that, yeah, what's painful to me and where I think third spaces can be very helpful is that there are a bunch of folks who are right at the cusp, right? They're at a fork in the road and they don't think something is for them just because of the environment that's been fostered around them. And I think the third space is an escape from all of that noise, from all of that nonsense that's been shutting people out, and just being a space where people can go explore, lock in, and discover who they're meant to be.
Yeah, and I've seen this like little tug of almost like this is what has brought people, I don't want to say back to the Dean, because then that like says this is Dean and this is not, but back to having a connection with their creator. Whereas formerly thinking, well, my creator has made me in a way that he cannot and will not love me. And that's a cruel creator. That's not a creator, I believe. And shout out to the LGBTQI+. Shout out to Amina Wadud and Baba Ibrahim. These are our brethren, right? And if you keep saying like, hey, you don't belong here, it's kind of like the, you know, we go back to Caminos and punk rock. And it's just kind of like, well, you're not Muslim enough for us. Where do you think they're going to go? If they can't go to the mosque, if they can't go to Juma because they feel completely less than, where are they going to go to get their connection?
But not even queer Muslims, right? Like this applies to Black Muslims. There's a lot of like Arab supremacy or Desi supremacy. Like if you don't follow a certain pattern, or you don't speak Arabic, or you don't do X, or you don't do Y, or you look a particular way, you don't belong here. Black Muslims feel this way a lot. I can't tell you how many times, you know, initially I think anything, you know, any Muslim or programming, a Black Muslim shows up and is immediately like, is this for us? Is this for me? So you can't blame the community when they created a, you know, there were like these Black-only iftars, because there's something about self-preservation and about community preservation that has to be fostered when a community feels like they don't belong, that they're not welcome. And this also happens to Shia Muslims, right? Like, and not just Twelver Shias who are like more accepted than Ismailis, but I can't tell you how many times I have Ismaili friends or Dawoodi, Bahora friends that are like, yeah, they are in Minara, and they're like, this is the first time I ever felt embraced by a Muslim community. And I'm technically Minara is not Muslim, right? Technically, Minara is a third space that centers marginalized communities. We are very inspired by the Islamic tradition and Muslim communities. We're inspired by the Majlis tradition, the Caravanserai tradition, etc. But different from Mipsters, right? Mipsters is very much for Muslim and Muslim adjacent artists. And creatives. But the Minara project, specifically learning from our Alhamdu Muslim Futurism project, was designed to just be a home for those in this, you know, existential, exploratory, social justice-oriented world. And it drew, obviously, a certain ilk of folks. But I constantly had to remind folks of, like, you know, people are like, oh, this is how we need Islam to be. And I'm like, yo, we are not a theological space. We're not a mosque. We're not even a second space, right? Like Talif Collective, that's a second space, right? Like these are spaces that are technically not mosques, but are for Muslims. We are not that. We are simply a space inspired by a particular tradition for everyone, and whoever it attracts, it attracts. We have 90-year-old white ladies who, you know, to anti-Zionist Jewish ladies coming through. We have little children. You know, we have everyone and anyone that have stepped foot in the space, just to give you like an idea of who we're capturing with Minara.
I got one hard-hitting question for you.
Yeah.
Would you allow a Zionist Muslim into your space?
A Zionist Muslim, you said?
Yeah. I mean, they exist, dude. Shout out. But I don't want to put any I don't want to give anybody free publicity here.
Call out to the Muslim Zionists.
Yeah, there are Muslim Zionists for sure. So you ask a very good question, right? It's not about allowing, right? Like I don't have the keys, you know, out of the door to say like you can and cannot come in. I think a Muslim Zionist who steps foot in the place will immediately have to confront.
You know, like that guy in Ottawa in Canada who came with the Israeli flag into the masjid and he started.
Are you for real?
Yeah. There was a, I think it was in Ottawa. Maybe it was some other, it was in Canada, but.
Yeah. I mean, you'll have to, I mean, these folks will just like have to really confront fundamental social justice principles, right? And I think that's where people get hung up, right? Yeah, I think it was a very simple thing when I think it was like, I don't know what award show this was, maybe the Oscars or the Golden Globes or something. Rami Youssef was talking to reporters saying that we are against the killing of children, right? Mm-hmm. Period. We're not talking about, you know, Israel. We're not talking about Zionism. We're just talking about hardline here, killing of children, right? And if you're like, but there is a, then we have a problem, right? Then there's a social justice framework that's breaking down. And I think the folks that are coming in, they're either trying to incite some sort of things, but the people who typically find themselves in Manara are those whose favorite sentence is, I don't know, you know? And it's just like, I don't know, we're all going to learn together, you know? And I think if you're not open to that, you very quickly will feel bored and step away. It reminds me of one of my like early days of Mipsters. We had this event called the PB and Jam session, where we basically had artists and musicians come by, and they all were performing in a jam, and they would bring all kinds of instruments: guitar, chanun, drum, piano, whatever, in Washington Square Park. And I volunteered to make various versions of peanut butter sandwiches, you know, like peanut butter and banana, peanut butter and jam. And I was just like handing it out to all of the passersby. And this one guy would stand around and be like, you know, you Muslims, you know what I think about you Muslims? And I was like, yo, man, you want peanut butter and banana, or you want peanut butter and jelly, man? And he's just like, you know what I think about you Muslims? And he stood there for 3 hours, ate two sandwiches, and listened to beautiful music. And we didn't even engage with the brother. We're like, look, man, I don't know. I'm not a political scientist. I don't know how to answer your question. He's like, yo, explain Al-Qaeda. And I was like, bro.
I'm just making sandwiches. I'm the peanut butter sandwich maker.
I'm just a dude who lives in New York City, man. Like, I don't know.
After 3 hours, what did he say?
He was like, man, F you guys, and just like walked away. But that kind of highlights like something internally was speaking to him, right? Well, you don't stay there for 3 hours if you're full of like hatred. At some point he was quiet and listening and jamming along to the kanun, you know? And so I was like, all right, man, but that summarizes, you know, a Zionist Muslim in the space. Like, what's their goal there? If their goal is to like incite and ruffle feathers, they're not going to find engaging, you know, people to engage with them. But if they're just like, yo, actually, like, talk to me, teach me, I'm trying to learn, I'm trying to, you know, you know, so.
You know, I always thought like the ultimate goal is inclusion. With Gamma, it's called gathering all Muslim artists. Like, that was always my idea, especially because I grew up very marginalized. Being Shia in Saudi Arabia was a trip. And then coming here and being Muslim in America post 9/11 was an even wilder trip. So I've just always been otherwise and on the margins. And I wanted to have everyone and be an inclusive space. But, you know, time has shown time and time again that, A, there's no such thing as an inclusive space, because that means you're also introducing people who don't believe in inclusivity, who are going to come and disrupt.
Yep.
And also, B, is that we don't actually need fully inclusive spaces, right? Not like you said before, Black Muslims need to have all Black spaces so that the mask can come off. Queer Muslims need to have all queer spaces so that the mask can come off.
And so that
inclusivity conundrum has been a trip and has been sort of like the narrative of the last decade of trying to figure that out. And so I really appreciate you touching upon sort of those themes throughout the interview here and really everything. It's beautiful work that you're doing. I would love to visit Manara. You know what? How much are flights to Boston right now? What are you doing next week?
Well, we're under renovation right now. We ran into some electrical breaker issues that we need upgrading. So once 2.0 is up and running, you got to come by.
Yeah, please do. Let me know.
That way, when we turn on the microwave, it doesn't short the fridge, you know?
Well, I'll bring a kettle in my backpack. You know, I don't even need a microwave.
Exactly, the Lota kettle, yeah.
Man, okay, what a trip. It's $200. You might see me show up next week.
Yo, please do. More than welcome.
Well, I was going to ask you one last question here.
Hit me with your another, fourth last question.
Another.
my kid is like, where's my baba?
Another hard-hitting last question here.
Yeah, yeah.
So you said you used to do stand-up comedy, right?
Yeah, yeah. Hard-hitting.
So give us your best joke right now.
That was a joke.
Give us your best.
I had you guys rolling this whole interview. I've been sprinkling jokes throughout.
Back in the 2000s or whenever you were doing it, what was your best one-liner that you had?
I don't know if you guys remember this, but LeBron used to put baby powder in his hands and then throw it up.
And you still do that, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah. So I did that for my first – I opened for Lewis Black and Kenan Thompson and Whitesnake. They were like, you know, SNL and Daily Show folks. And so nobody knew who I was. I was the opening act. And I go out, throw up this cloud, and everyone's like, oh, yeah, LeBron reference. And I was like, yo, that was Anthrax. everyone paused. They were like, yeah. Yo, what?
That's a good one. That's a good one. I like that.
Immediately threw everybody off.
Yeah, that's beautiful. Yeah. I'm going to edit in the sound of a huge applause there as well. That was,
No, nobody applauded. They were like, the moment they were like, oh, yeah, yeah, cool, cool. And I was like, yeah, that was Anthrax. And then everyone was like, oh, okay. Oh, hell no. You can't. It's too soon.
Wait, is he serious?
It was around the time of the Anthrax scare and everything. So yeah. People were like, yo, okay, hold up. This dude is not, we cannot play right now.
Perfect. That's time. Hilarious. You know, send everyone home with an envelope with a gift card.
That's beautiful. You know, you heard of Ahmed, the comedian?
Of course. I saw him. Yeah. I saw him when he came to Duke.
Did you hear about when he got someone in the audience called the police on him because of a joke?
No.
It kind of reminds me of that joke you just talked about, the Anthrax. He made a reference of like, he didn't say we're going to blow up this whole room, but he said, oh, you know, it just takes one of us, you know, because he was asking how if there's any Middle Eastern people in the crowd. And then
it's provocative, man.
Only takes one of us. And then, you know, somebody called the cops on him because of that joke. I was like, what the heck?
Hey, well, he's reaching the audience.
At least the audience is listening, dude. They were listening so intently that they acted.
Yeah.
That's a beautiful thing, man. Well, thank you so much for your time. I know you got to get back to Baba duties. And yeah, let's keep this conversation going, Chella. Let's stay connected.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for having me on the show. Can't wait for the final episode. Curious what people are going to say, dude. Send me all of the backlash.
Thank you so much for tuning into the Artistic Foodies. Before we go, show some love for your favorite podcast by leaving us a review on Apple Podcasts.
Be sure to find us on Facebook and Instagram to stay tuned for more episodes as well as bonus content. You can have access to all of our episodes on our website, theartisticfoodies.com.
This podcast has been brought to you by Halal Fest Incorporated.